We'll call the Senate Tax Committee to order for April 8th, 2015. Senator Rest, Senate File 1251.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 1251 has had a pathway through more than one committee, and it did get sent to the floor. We'll be sending it back to the floor today, I hope, but I thought it was important that the Tax Committee take a look at it as well. It involves the issues of the relationships between, in this case, Hennepin County and a railroad that is seeking to, or exploring a project that would end up with a connector rail in one of my cities that would bring a lot of additional train traffic through Robbinsdale and Crystal and Golden Valley. And the bill itself would limit the authority of the railroads to impose and exercise eminent domain.
Senator Rest, could you pull the mic over just a little bit? Thank
sure. Eminent domain on county-owned property if the county deemed that the project imperiled public safety. Obviously, we are dealing with some railroad issues in the Tax Committee, and it seemed that although it's a bill's been to the floor, and as I said, hope you'll send it back there, that it was worth a brief stop here because it would have property tax implications. And the bill itself, we believe to be a mere, I mean, not mere, it's important, an important class clarifications of state law and the relationship between two authorities that do have the power of eminent domain in the state.
Any questions, members? And members, this bill was on the floor, and we referred it back to taxes so we could take a little look at it, and it will go be sent back to the floor if it moves out of the committee today. Any questions, members? Anyone in the audience wish to testify on Senate File 1251? Eminent domain issue for railroads. Seeing nothing, Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, then I would move that Senate File 1251 be recommended to pass.
Senator Rest moves Senate
Mr.
File.
Chair, 12. Senator
Sengen.
Mr. Chair, I think the bill speaks for itself, but Senator Rest, I have for a long time thought that railroads had eminent domain authority by virtue of federal law. Is that not the case?
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sengen, eminent domain is granted by the states.
Okay.
And railroads, I don't think there's any state that has not granted railroads. And I know in Minnesota we also grant eminent domain to private but public utilities as well, like Xcel and so forth.
Yeah. Thank you. That's all.
And so, Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate File 1251 be recommended to pass.
And members, we do have a quorum. All those in favor of Senator Rest's motion?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you,
Senator
very
Rest.
Much.
Senator Rest, Senate File 1354, Tax Court.
Mr. Chairman, there's an issue with, which one is it?
Tax Court
1354. There's an issue with this bill that came to our attention. Came to our attention yesterday afternoon. That is an issue that the Judiciary Committee has jurisdiction over, and with that in mind, and I think this has happened to another bill. I think was Senator Thompson's bill, where we're going to remove the sections that remain the jurisdiction of the Tax Committee and then send the Section 3 to have a separate motion and send it to the Judiciary Committee. So I'll explain the bill, and then we can take those actions so that it's whole while we're talking about it. And it is, first of all, it's in the first section, it is a timing change for serving motions for rehearings. Right now, those two time periods are not in sync with one another. And so the first section does that in terms of changing it from 15 days to 30 days. And then motions with regard to tax court are changed from 30 days to 60 days. In Section 2, there is a proposed increase in the threshold for small claims court from $5,000 to $15,000. And I have to check my notes here for, I just found it. It's been since the mid-'80s since that threshold has been changed. And then the third issue in the bill in Section 3, which is more properly the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee, provides that funds and additional revenues can be used by the tax court for their, in general, their operating expenses beyond that of just hiring clerks. And it's pretty straightforward, but that is a judiciary finance issue. And so with that explanation, Mr. Chairman, I would move to delete Sections 1 and 2 so that they can remain in front of the Tax Committee. And that's an author's motion.
And members, Senator Ress is moving that we delete Sections 1 and 2, which are in the Tax Committee's jurisdiction. They're relatively minor changes to the tax court. The Section 3, the appropriation, was an appropriation we made a couple of years ago when the tax court had quite a backlog of cases, and we thought that this would help them get caught up. I think they have, and now they're wanting a little flexibility on how that money is utilized. But that would be a judiciary finance issue.
So, Mr. Chairman, I think it's straightforward. I think there's probably somebody here who can answer questions, but I'm not sure that it's necessary.
Well, first, let's take Section 1 and 2 out. On Senator Ress's motion to delete Section 1 and 2, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Anything else, members? Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 1354?
Chairman Brad Dela Pena.
Judge Dela Pena.
I'm here to answer questions if you have any.
Thank you.
Good testifier.
Very good testimony. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of Senate File 1354 as amended being referred to Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The bill's referred. That was the right motion. Senator Rest, I think we have one more.
Which one is it? Which one is
828.
That? 828. Mr. Chairman, Senate File. Good morning. Senate File 828 brings, it recognizes the changing climate with regard to interest rates on unpaid balances of tax forfeited property. And what's been in place has been an interest rate imposed that would be whatever it is, a couple of points above prime, up to 14%, but no less than 10%. And I think on those unpaid balances. And I think we all know that that's a pretty high rate as a floor in today's climate, where we borrow mortgages at 3.5% and not even, you know, home equity loans. We get at 3% and so forth. Credit card debt is a lot higher than that, but that's not who these folks are. And so the proposal is to keep the upper rate above prime, but to make the lower rate no less than 5. So it would always be 5% minimum, but it could be as high as 2 points above prime, but no greater than 14%. So it's really just changing the lower number, is my understanding.
And Senator Rest, being that this is tax forfeit land, these parcels are quite a ways down the line from being able to be solvent
this
again.
Beyond so foreclosure. This is way down the line.
It's yes. Tax forfeit. Any questions of Senator Rest? Ms. Koala?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Senator Rest. My name is Chris Koala. I'm the supervisor of the Tax Forfeited Land Division within Property Records and Revenue for Ramsey County. Our proposal is to seek a change in the interest rate for sales contracts of tax forfeited land and also repurchase contracts of tax forfeited land to mirror the interest rate that's currently being charged on confession of judgment contracts. That was legislation that was introduced last year in 2014, and the interest rate was reduced to 5%. And we are seeking to mirror that same interest rate on repurchase contracts and sales contracts, which would be the 5% or the 2% above prime, as Senator Ress had explained.
And the cap is 14%?
The cap is 14%.
Any other questions, members? Anyone in the audience wish to testify on Senate File 828? Senator Rest's initiative to lower costs on these parcels. Seeing nothing, Chair will lay Senate File 828 over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much, Senator Rest.
Is that the last one?
That's the last one.
Okay.
Members, we have minutes. If you have had time to review them, maybe Senator Eaton moves the minutes for March 25th and March 26th. Any corrections or omissions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you. Senator Dahl. Senate File 1146.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members. Senate File 1146, if you look at the bill, and you can see Subdivision 2, it says under current law there must be at least one member of each meeting of a local board of appeal and equalization who's attended an appeals and equalization course within the last 4 years. This type of training has been required of local members of the Board of Appeals and Adjustments since 2006, and training has been offered in person in many locations, including with the Minnesota Association of Townships, where several hundred officials are trained each year. The Minnesota Association of Townships was notified by the department that November 2014 would be the last in-person training offered, and online training is not a viable option. So what the bill does, this proposal would exempt boards from meeting the requirement in any year in which in-person training is not offered by the Commissioner of Revenue, and the exemption would be available until the Office of Broadband Development certifies that broadband service exists in every jurisdiction with the local Board of Appeal and Equalization, effective of June 1st of 2015. I have Kent Sulem, the legal counsel for the Minnesota Association of Townships, to fill in any gaps or answer any questions.
Mr. Sulem.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Kent Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. Senator Dahl did a great job of explaining the bill. It is pretty straightforward. This is one of the few times that you'd probably find a local government not opposing a mandate. Our folks are actually finding great value in the training. They want to remain trained. They want to be able to do a good job with the Board of Appeals and Equalization. However, as the Senator mentioned, our folks right now do best with in-person training. We don't have high-speed internet in most of the truly rural areas. The video option might be there, but it's not ideal at this time anyhow. And so we were simply trying to have a holding place of not getting rid of the mandate completely. We want the training of option to still be there, but trying to buy us some time to work with revenue to figure out how do we go forward doing the training. Just the introduction of the bill has already had good success. And Mr. Chair, I believe you had a productive meeting with the commissioner. And we have a commitment that they will continue to do in-person training with our association for this summer for our short courses in June. And we are hopeful that going forward we can figure out what the alternative will be to continue providing the training, including perhaps that they could become train our staff, my colleagues, so we could do the training on behalf of revenue directly. But that's all we're trying to accomplish is buy us some time to keep figuring out the best option so we can have fully trained and people actually getting the mandate they don't oppose.
And Senator Dahl, as Mr. Sula mentioned, we have had some meetings with the Department of Revenue, and I would like them to come forward and put on the tape some of the discussions that we've had with regard to what might be alternatives, so it's clear for the townships and you what might be options that would work for everybody in this regard. So, Mr. Cummings. Welcome, Mr. Cummings.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Thank you for the opportunity to be a resource. Currently, there's about 5,100 local and county board members that are trained and will need to be retrained over the next 4 years. So we share the goal with the townships in providing a fair and transparent way for residents to receive a hearing on their local appeals. The cost of in-person training will vary for each jurisdiction based on travel needs, but those costs will be reduced with new e-learning options. There have been concerns raised about the ability to access these new options based on broadband internet capacity across the state. Mr. Chair, we've recently completed full implementation of our ECRV program, Certificate of Real Estate Value. While this is different in many ways, in that process, we work to address concerns about internet access as we move forward with a system that is more efficient and cost-effective. One solution has already been presented for that, counties being able to provide computer stations for people to take part in this training. The e-learning alternative, Mr. Chair, for townships is actually a shorter training because of the interactivity that it would provide. Mr. Chair, in addition to the e-learning, we plan on teaching this course in person 8 times this year, and that's something that we would continue to do. As we transition to a new and streamlined systems, it may make sense, as you've talked about, Mr. Chair, and as Mr. Sulem and Senator Dahl have talked about, to have some targeted transition training times and opportunities to explain and teach people how to use the new e-learning modules in person, and to also provide some targeted times where the townships that might meet the needs of the townships the best in the places of the state that might work the best. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to be a resource. We certainly look forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl, the Minnesota Association of Townships, to try and find something that'll work.
And members, what we think is going to happen is that over the next couple of years, part of the in-person training is going to be exposure to the e-training, which would be available at the county seat if they didn't have access in their home. And so the township officers will become familiar with it, and hopefully we'll transition to that. But we clearly want to keep the in-person option alive for a while until we see how all this works. So that's been the kind of the gist of the conversation, and we want to make sure that the committee's aware of where we're heading with this and where we're trying to go, and make sure that Mr. Solom and his organization is comfortable with it also. Any questions, members? Anything else, Senator Dahl?
No. Oh,
Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dahl or any of the witnesses, I'm looking at line 120 to line 122, and I may be misreading this, but if for instance, 85% of the state does have broadband, why would we not give that 85% a chance for in-person training? It seems to read that we're not going to do or suspend in-person training requirement until the whole state's, outfitted, if you will, with broadband.
Senator Senjum, my expectation is that the bill is going to be amended.
Okay.
We weren't quite ready for the amendment today.
Okay.
But Mr. Solem, could you address that, please?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Senator Senjum, that provision was put in because of the fact that with the e-training and the early discussions had occurred, and also with the transition that was occurring within the department, our folks are saying we can't do it. We need the online, or we need high speed before we can do it. And so we were just trying to have, again, the placeholder of what is a viable option, how do we get it out there? And so this was the placeholder language to say we want high speed in rural Minnesota. We need high speed in rural
right.
Minnesota. And this is one more reason it would be a benefit. We can provide better training if we have it. So it was just the concept of they're either going to be there in person or the technology will actually make it viable. Either one would work for us, but right now we don't have the technology side.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Senjum.
So in certain areas of the state where this broadband is available, it won't be used until it's available to everyone. Is that correct? It doesn't make sense to me, but I guess that's the way I read this.
Mr. Chair,
Mr.
Senator Senjum, again, I think that's part of the transition training that Mr. Cummings was talking about,
okay.
That we need to do some training on how to use e-training, how to make it effective.
Okay.
So in the interim, the idea is that we'll have a little bit of both available. They'll continue to do in-person with us and phase us into the e-learning as areas of the state are wired. So we'll work on final language with the chair before the final bill is out. But the idea was to stress that it's not viable to towns unless they have high speed.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sanders.
Just to ask, back in my city council days, we would revert into the Board of Equalization, I think, once a year. And we, of course, had no training or anything like that. In more recent times, is training required of city and county officers, electeds?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sanders.
Mr. Solem.
Training is required for any local office. So. The cities and towns have training. I believe there's still training for the counties, but it's not the same training that we have because
okay.
Counties have different obligations with their board.
Sure. My question was simply, things evolve, but training is now required of those city and county officers, the way it sounds. Is that correct?
Mr. Cummings, do you know?
I believe, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe that on these local boards of equalization, one member of the board needs to go through the training, even though the whole board may revert to being a local board of equalization.
Okay.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My comments are somewhat along the lines of Senator Senjum's, and I guess I would make a suggestion. It appears that we all realize the training is essential, but there's some concern about what mode that training will be delivered in. And I'm just wondering why on line 1.19, instead of requiring that the person has attended an appeals and equalization course developed or approved by, why would we not change that to completed an appeals and equalization course? And it doesn't say anything in the current language about, if you use the word completed, it doesn't say anything. That would not indicate at all that we are legislating the mode or the way that instruction is delivered. And to Senator Senjum's point, I don't know that it is in the best interest for the state to say that the instruction must be delivered in this mode. In some cases, certainly an online delivery of instruction would be
far superior and would give more options to the board member taking that. In other cases, requiring online would not be wise either, because maybe some people don't choose to do online. Maybe they don't have the broadband access. But I do find that this could be solved very easily just by changing that word attended to completed. And also, I find lines 1.20 to 1.23, section C, just a little bit unusual that we would have the Office of Broadband certify that broadband is certified in every jurisdiction. Well, then do we need to certify that every person has access to a computer, or then do we need to certify that every person wants to take it online? I just see that my suggestion, and I would be to delete Section 3, and on 1.9, change the word attended to completed. And that way there would be significant flexibility in how this necessary instruction is delivered. And I'm wondering if I could get the Senator Dahl to comment on that suggestion.
And certainly, Senator. But first let me say, there's nothing like scheduling a hearing on a bill to bring folks together for conversations. And as I indicated in my comments, we have been ongoing with meetings to try to resolve what's going on within the bill. Now, there's always risk of the scheduling of the hearing, because if you don't get it done by the time of the hearing, then you're with the language as the bill was introduced. My expectation, members, is that this will be available for online for those that have access to it. But the heart of the matter is that there will be some township officers that don't have access to it or aren't familiar with it or are uncomfortable with it, and we want to maintain the in-person training for those individuals. So the language in the Senate file is going to be amended before, as we put our bill together. So you're going to get a chance to see this again. And but the intent is to allow online where it's available, have in-person where it's not. But for the in-person training that is going to be going on at their regional meetings and elsewhere, we want part of that training to include the new online version so people start to become familiar with it. And over time, the expectation is that as service increases across the state, people become familiar with it, we will transition to that. But Senator Dahl, to the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think you've summed it up pretty well. And to paragraph C, it's a may be suspended. I think, again, we're trying to transition here. You know, we had a system that works, and now we have a system that really needs some transition. So we're trying to buy some time. And, again, with the conviction that the people sitting here and with your input will hopefully come up with a final language that will work for everyone.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
And thank you for the comments, Mr. Chair and Senator Dahl. And I agree totally with the comments that you made as far as moving forward. Mm-hmm. But that's not really what I see in the bill before us today at all.
No.
Okay. And so we would hope to see that. And then I just have one further question. So I will not offer my suggestion as an amendment here in committee. I know that the bill will be progressing to the
Senator Nelson.
End. You meet. But my question is, where does it require an in-person training in current law? Because line 1.9 says who has attended a course. And one could construe that attending a course is, you know, taking the course online. So is there some other spot in statute that says this must be an in-person training, and maybe it's just not in the bill before us?
Senator Nelson, I'm just checking with Senate counsel, and maybe Mr. Cummings, can you help us? Mr. Sewell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, there is now provision that requires that. That's the reason we have this provision saying we need, at least in the short term, to mandate the in-person option. Because right now, law just says they have to have completed the course in whatever format. It's sure. Been done in person. It's been live training since the inception of in 2006. When the department informed us that they were phasing out that option for us, That's when our member said, hey, now we have a mandate we can't meet because we don't have a viable option. So the reason we put the in-person provision in is because it's not there right now. We need it in there, at least for the short term, while we transition over.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. Well, it would make more sense then to just say in the legislation that an in-person option must exist until significant other choices are available. But I will not pursue this any further, knowing that this is going to be
And Senator Nelson, it's very good conversation. And part of the problem with what we're trying to resolve is we don't want to put a requirement in place that is onerous to the department, but on the other hand, we want to make sure these in-person trainings are available. So we're trying to make sure that at the 8 regional summer township meetings, clearly they'd be available there. And then we've had conversation about maybe if the township association knows of an area or a region that is going to be less availability for the electronic broadband, that we could do a few more. And we're just trying to find the language that would allow that to happen without, you know, being too prescriptive.
So, Mr. Chair, so I think that's very important. And we also have to know that there are all types of other trainings that are mandated in this state, whether they be insurance professionals, financial professionals, real estate professionals, appraisers. And so I am very worried, though, about this language in Part C, because it really sets a dangerous precedent for all the other type of training that we have and require.
And members, I think to that point, when we have some draft language, why don't I send it out to all the members
so you
can take a look at it? Would that be okay?
Yes, thank you.
Anything else, members? Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 1146? We'll get the language to the members as we work on it. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Sulem, Senator Dahl. Anything else, Senator Dahl?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Cheryl A., Senate File 1146 over for possible inclusion. Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 1058 is a bill that deals with the Conservation Reserve Program and its tax classification. Right now, the Conservation Reserve Program acreage is classified as 2B non-homestead rural vacant land with a class rate of 1%. Now, I had a constituent that had contacted me in regard to this because they had CRP acreage that was in the federal conservation program, and they had been taxed at the 0.5%, and it had been classified as productive ag land prior to this last year. There was a new assessor that came in, and suddenly that changed. And so they approached me about it. We looked into it. And, in fact, according to the state, it is not to be counted as productive ag land if it was after 2003. Now, I don't know what the magic is about the year 2003, but any CRP acreage that was put in prior to 2003 is counted as productive ag land. Any land that was put into CRP after 2003 is not. So this bill basically makes it all productive farmland, regardless of when it went into the Conservation Reserve Program. And I think that I think it's justified. For one thing, it has to be productive ag land in order to go into the conservation program. The federal government requires that it be productive ag land. And also, you still get ag income every year paid by the federal government. So you're still getting ag income, and it's classified when you do your taxes, it's classified as ag income. And also, you still have to do maintenance on that land. Even though you're planning to get into grasses, you still need to do mowings, you still need to sometimes do spraying, you need to control the weeds. So there's still work that's involved in it. So for that reason, we have put forward this bill, which, again, would classify all CRP lands as productive ag land, and then it would be eligible for the ag homestead credit, which reduces the tax rate from the 1 down to the 0.5. And that's the bill in a nutshell. I also have Tom May here from the Assessors Association, the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. And I thought it's interesting that there are a number of assessors that are currently assessing land that was put in after 2003 as productive ag land. So there's already a lot of folks that are assessors that are doing that, so the impact financially would be negligible as far as any kind of tax shift is concerned.
Mr. May.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name's Tom May. I'm the retired Hennepin County Assessor, and I'm representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers as their secretary. Senate File 1058 is confusing to us, and as confusing as the partner in the House. We're not sure what it changed. We've checked with all our ag experts around the state, and they all say that CRP acreage is currently ag. That's the way they look at it. Basically, as Senator Eakin mentioned, it has to be ag to go into the program. The only thing we know is that the information to whether a property is CRP or not is really private data. It's not something the assessor has at his disposal. So it does require the taxpayer to bring forward that to the assessor to show that the acreage is in CRP. Otherwise, it could look like, you know, non-productive land if we're not sure of it. So what we'd like to do, if this is a specific situation, we'd like to work with Senator Eakin and try to identify those and see what the problem is out there, so we make sure that assessors in the state are all doing that the same. But it's our interpretation from our experts that we're doing that now.
Mr. May, just so I'm clear, currently, under FSA, in order to be CRP, it has to have been producing a crop prior to CRP. So it currently had to be ag land. There would have been no rural vacant land that would qualify for CRP. So it goes from ag land, they sign up for CRP, and you are telling me the assessors are leaving that in the ag classification during the CRP time period?
Yes. Okay. Unless there's some specific situation where that's not the case, we'd like to know that so we can investigate that.
Okay, very good. Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So along those lines, Mr. May, what Senator Eakin is proposing, you're not really opposed to, you're just not sure why some of the assessors are doing what they're doing.
Oh, absolutely, not opposed
Mr.
at
May.
All.
I'm okay.
Just wondering what the language changes. That's our main issue.
And Senator Gazalka, another reason for us to continue down our path with assessor training. Anything else, members? And Senator Eakin, could you work with the assessors in the area where this is occurring and see if we can figure that out so we don't need to do something confusing and, you know, more confusing in law?
Sure, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to.
Okay, and members, I think the policy of this is that with regard to these acres, they were agriculture prior to the CRP, and it's not like they're producing nothing. They are growing grass, maintenance is required, and they are receiving an ag payment. So I think the policy is right. We just have to make sure that it's being implemented uniformly across the state. Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And over time, you know, it probably looks less like ag land, but that's the whole purpose, is to set it aside. And so no, I think we're heading the right direction.
Yeah. Anything else? Senator Sanjim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Eakin, and this is probably premature, but you know, over the course of, you know, the recess, I attended two of these buffer meetings with a whole bunch of farmers, and it seems to me that the governor and his staff are suggesting that buffer lands go into CRP and so on and so forth, and now we're saying that same, if that's the case, then that would continue to get taxed like productive ag land, as I'm understanding. And I've been thinking, frankly, driving down the road of, you know, if we're going to go to the required buffer world, why, you know, that ought to be a separate classification of taxation. But I'm not just exactly sure of all the dots on this one, but it seems to me that, you know, if the buffer initiative goes forward, that's going to require some additional conversation about how that land is taxed. And I just offered as a comment.
Sure, and Senator Sanjim, I think the current law with regard to buffers is that they buy the 16 and a half feet, the one rod. So that actually, the land is actually purchased. The other thing, I have had some conversations about this. If there are CRP or CREP or other easements placed on the lands next to ditches for water quality, they would be eligible for evaluation change because of the water quality component. But hopefully that's a ways away, so we can have some time to have this conversation, because I think you're absolutely right. It is,
Mr. Chair,
it's
maybe
pretty involved.
Maybe 6 weeks away.
Anything
or
else?
Less.
Anything else, members? Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 1058? Senator Eakin?
No more comments.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
I encourage you to contact, and maybe the association will contact the assessors up there and make sure that we're getting that done consistently across the state. So thank you very much, Chair. I'll lay Senate File 1058 over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Eakin.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Stump.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome, Senator Stump. Senate File 1865.
This has to do with the city of Oslo. And living in northwestern Minnesota, Mr. Chair, probably realize or know that the city of Oslo has had an awful lot of activity in that community over the last several years. And we've been working closely with them to get their dikes recertified and to develop a plan for them. And then also, it wasn't last winter, but the winter before, they ended up with 38 water main breaks. And some of that, really, nobody, even the engineers, don't know exactly why the water main breaks occurred. It was a very cold winter, and we didn't have much snow cover early on, and some of that may have attributed to the number. But they ended up having to pay for fixing these water main breaks. And so that after that occurred, we sat down with all of the interested parties to try to look at how we can replace the water mains or the water pipes in town. And once you do the water pipes, you might as well do the sewer. So, I mean, it was kind of like the whole town was under an enormous amount of upheaval and remodeling. And then along came the election, and Heather from the League of Minnesota Cities, we were just talking, almost had a whole new city council and mayor and clerk. And so what happened is all of this attributed to them not getting their audit in on time. And, well, they did get an extension, but even with the extension, they still didn't quite get it in on time. They did get it in October 28th, but obviously they lost the LGA payment, which was $37,473. So what the new mayor and the city is asking for is there some way that they they're a relatively small town, and they would really appreciate the having that LGA payment to operate with.
And Senator Stump, I don't know if you know this or not, but in 97, I spent a week in Oslo. There was in the middle of the flood of 97, and being a rice farmer, we have airboats. And so I would stay in Warren and drive about two-thirds of the way to Oslo and back my airboat in the ditch and go right down Highway 1, right into Oslo, tie up at the stop sign there by their ring dike, talk to the emergency management person, and go around and deliver supplies and people around the area. The river was about 20 miles wide at that time, and here was this little island of 300 people. Hauling dirt 24 hours a day on their dikes was really something.
Recorded up.
It was really something. But anyway, I have a little soft spot for Oslo. So did you have something to add to the conversation?
Mr. Chair, it's Heather Corcoran with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'm here for questions. The mayor of Oslo would have loved to be here. To her credit, she's in New York. She was called on FEMA reserve duty last week, and so she's well familiar with emergency management and appreciates the committee's consideration to fix this.
Any questions, members? Ms. Donata, do you know, has this happened before? Is this the first time for the city?
I believe, this is Heather Corcoran with the League of Minnesota Cities. I believe this is the first time Oslo's been in this situation.
Yeah. Maybe Senator Stump, that if they could get some information to us on that, that would be helpful. Anything else, members? Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 1865? Seeing none. Anything else, Senator Stump?
No, thank you for taking the opportunity to listen to this.
Okay. Chair will lay Senate File 1865 over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Senator Coonan.
Mr. Chair, I have a handout, if a page could assist.
Look at the page up there after he's done passing out what he's doing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Coonan, Senate File 1252, cigarette stamp modification.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under current law, cigarette distributors are charged for the tax value of the cigarette stamps, the cost of the stamps, and also the shipping costs of the stamps. And what the bill does, and I do have an amendment to the bill.
Senator Coonan, I see you have the A1 amendment. This is your first stop. Should we put this on as an
amendment? Yeah, let's do that, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coonan moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. A1's adopted.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator
Chairman.
Senator Coonan.
And so what the bill does, now with the amendment, is the stamps are discounted at 0.45% from the stamp face value. And to explain that a little bit more in detail, the face value in 2015 is $2.90 per pack excise tax plus 52.6 cents per pack in lieu of sales tax. And what the proposal does with this proposal, the 0.45% applies to the $2.90 per cent excise tax, not the 52.6 cents per pack sales tax. And so that's the discount there. And then the actual cost of the stamps will not be paid by the cigarette distributors. And just a little background on this. Currently, 48 states pay a cigarette stamping allowance to wholesalers. Only in Minnesota and New Hampshire do not. And Minnesota for allowed a stamping allowance to wholesalers for around 40 years before it was repealed back in 2003, and that was for a budget balancing procedures back then when we had a fairly large deficit in at that time. And wholesalers incur approximately $2.2 million in costs to stamp cigarettes for the state, which includes purchasing or renting stamping machines, paying for the machine maintenance, buying software to run the machine, and, of course, the people that they pay to operate the machines. And if you look at the revenue estimate, you'll see there that with the cigarette stamp discount in the first year is $1.9 million, and then after that $2.1 million. And the stamp cost is $100,000 ongoing each year after that. And so you're looking at, in the first year, $2 million, and then $2.2 million after that. And so the bill pretty much lines up with the cost to the wholesale distributors. And that's pretty much the bill, Mr. Chairman. If you're ready, I do have a couple of testifiers.
Anything for Senator Coonan? Mr. Erickson?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Dale Erickson, and I am the general manager of Henry's Foods, a wholesale distribution company located in Alexandria. We sell snacks, beverages, candy, food items, and tobacco products to retailers. We brought our concerns about the need to reinstate a cigarette stamping allowance to Senator Kuhn, and we would appreciate your support of this bill. As Senator Koonin indicated, wholesalers incur significant costs to comply with the state's requirements that cigarette stamps be affixed to each pack of cigarettes. The stamping of cigarettes with a tax stamp does not benefit Henry's Foods or any other wholesaler. Rather, the stamping is done for the benefit of the state to ensure tax compliance. While each wholesaler cost will vary, Henry's Foods incurs the following costs to stamp cigarettes. And if you would take the handout that I gave you and go to page 4 and 5, you will see just a picture of a tax stamping machine that I just wanted to show you so that you can visualize what I'm talking about here with the tax stamping machine. We as Henry's Foods purchased our cigarette stamping machine approximately 10 years ago for $109,000, and we paid Minnesota sales tax on that machine. And after 10 years, we're looking at now possibly having to replace it because of all the, you know, cigarettes that we have stamped through that machine to a tune of at least, I haven't looked at current price, but I'm sure it hasn't gone down any. To ensure that we keep the machine running, we stock about $10,000 in machine parts at our warehouse. We also pay $2,610 a year to the machine manufacturer for a maintenance and service contract to cover service calls and repairs of the stamping machine. In addition, we at Henry's have two full-time employees whose job it is to stamp cigarettes every day. Their wages and benefits add up to approximately $78,000 per year. The software to make the machine operate was $9,000 a year. And we also pay an annual software support fee of $8,000 a year. We also have warehouse space dedicated to the stamping machine and incur utility costs to operate the machine. Finally, we also reimburse the state for the cost of printing the tax stamps. In short, not including the purchase price for our stamping machine, Henry's Foods incurs more than $100,000 a year in software expense and direct costs to stamp cigarettes for the state of Minnesota. This means that since the stamping allowance was repealed 11 years ago, Henry's Foods has incurred more than $1 million to purchase machines and pay off the expenses necessary to stamp cigarettes for the state of Minnesota. On behalf of all the wholesalers of Minnesota, we are only asking that we be reimbursed for the cost we incur to stamp cigarettes for the state. And again, I guess I'm looking at fairness, and Senator Koonin did not elaborate on it, but I would like to compare it a little bit to the lottery, where, if you're all aware of it, the state provides the machines for the lottery, and the state also pays the retailer for every ticket that they sell, and the state also reimburses the state, I believe, a certain percentage for winning tickets. And again, we're just looking for a fairness from the state for all of the effort and work that we do to collect the state sales tax. And if you do have it in any of your printouts, last year that was roughly $458 million that we collected for the state.
Mr. Bryant.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Bryant, and I am the executive director of the Minnesota Wholesale Marketers Association, a trade association of cigarette distributors here in the state, and Henry's Foods is one of those members. I just have one other comment, then we can take questions if the committee members have them. The cigarette wholesalers collected $458 million in cigarette taxes in fiscal year 2014. According to the Revenue Department, that's about 7% surplus, or about $32 million more than what was projected. The cost of the stamping allowance is about $2.2 million as it goes forward. So we just certainly appreciate your consideration of going back to what the state had for some 40 years, and like 40 other states, reimburse our wholesalers for the direct costs they incur to collect that $458 million a year for the benefit of the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bryant. Senator Koonin, you're kind of tracking along with Senator Rest's vendor allowance on sales tax collection. And we'll have to look and see what the interactions are, because I think the cigarette sales would fall within her bill also. So we'd have to see how the interactions are with that. Questions, members? Senator Artman.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Senator Conan, why do we need the stamps anyway?
That's probably
Senator Conan.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, that's probably a question the department that should answer more, but it has to do with the collecting and the keeping track of the collection.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I was going to ask the department if they could answer the question. I just thought I'd like to hear what Senator Conan had to say before I asked the Department of Revenue. It seems like a very outdated way to ensure that taxes are being paid, and I would also like to know if the department can give other examples of where we stamp the products that get taxed and go through that process and impose that on the distributors. I'm just interested that maybe we just have a very outdated system entirely that needs to go by the wayside.
As we go to the center rest.
Just to add to that question, I would be interested for them to respond of, is there any state that doesn't have a stamp, and how does that work with the federal requirements, too?
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Ortman, the stamps for cigarettes, it is it's a powerful way in order to help with compliance. Immediately when a person either buys a cigarette or if a person goes in to check in terms of compliance, you know immediately if the tax has been paid. So this is it's a way in which that can happen. Now, this year we've talked about an increase in the level of smuggling. We've also talked about things that deal with the amount of seizures that have been happening, an increase in the amount of seizures. But we've typically seen those in the products, the tobacco products that are not stamped, because the stamp is really a powerful marker of whether the tax has been paid. So we do see many of the states have moved in the direction of stamping their cigarettes. We did have a discussion a few years ago about little cigars and whether they should be stamped. What the discussion was is that on the one hand, stamping items like cigarettes is a powerful method to have a level playing field in terms of whether there is the tax has been paid. If we have some taxpayers who are paying the tax and there are other taxpayers who are not, especially when the tax rate is a higher tax rate, then that creates an unequal playing field. So as we have with tobacco, we have found that people, because it is not stamped, you can't easily tell whether the tax is paid. You actually have to ask for the receipts and see if the receipts have been paid. So we want to make sure that there's a level playing field. Now, it isn't, you know, it's very difficult to apply stamps to things that are not of the same size. It's easier to apply stamps to cigarettes because a pack of cigarettes is, there are standard sizes. So that is easy to do. So across the country, there is no state that asks that stamps be applied to tobacco products. But in terms of moving away from that regulation, would also, we believe that would lead to an increase in smuggling. We believe that would be a distortion within the market in terms of who is paying the tax and who is not. If you're asking, are there other states that do not have stamps? Yes, there are other states that do not stamp cigarettes. I believe North Dakota is one of them. There have been efforts even this year. There have been bills to have a stamp. I don't think that we'll be moving forward this year, but there are other states that do not have a stamp.
Mr. Cummings, so the other tobacco products, cigars, snus, that stuff is not stamped, but cigarettes are.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. And they do have to, but we do want to make sure that there is a level playing field, and so we do have regulations that they must keep their receipts on site, keep their receipts close to where that happens so we can tell if the tax has been paid if we go out and do an audit. But, you know, recently we found that, you know, 17% of the amount of inspections that we've gone out and done we've found tobacco products that have not had the tax paid on them at some locations. And 17% is a very high amount. You know, 5 or 6 years ago, we found a rate of maybe 2%. So, and if you can't tell if the tax has been paid, that's something that, you know, we would want to look into.
Senator Artman.
Well, Mr. Chair, we've had bills before to put stamps on other tobacco products to make it consistent, and we have opposed that. And I think maybe we should be looking at the opposite approach. If you're looking at tax stamps for purposes of law enforcement instead of tax compliance, I think we should really look at this again. And it looks to me and sounds to me like you can do tax compliance without these stamps, which are a huge cost to the manufacturers. And so if other states can go without stamps, I think we should consider going without stamps. And I'd like to see what the department would, how they would do that. I mean, Mr. Cummins, maybe you can respond over the course of the, after session, about what it would look like if we eliminated the tax stamp altogether and where the impacts would be. But you're still doing compliance. You're just talking about a convenience for compliance on one type of tobacco product just because there are so many. I just don't think there's a good justification anymore for these stamps, honestly.
Mr. Erickson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Artman, I'll make a comment on that because it would be great if we didn't have to stamp cigarettes. I mean, it obviously would be. But I think you really need to realize I sell cigarettes in 5 states. North Dakota does not have a tax stamp. If Minnesota went to no tax stamp, and with the roughly $30 a carton difference between Minnesota and North Dakota, you wouldn't be getting your $458 million anymore. The state of North Dakota would be getting, I mean, retailers would go to North Dakota in droves and bring their cigarettes back because there's no way to track it other than this gentleman going out and doing a compliance check every store, every liquor store, every place out there. So it is needed. I'd love to not have to stamp because I wouldn't have this $100,000 a year expense, but you would really create a bootlegging situation immediately if it happened. So
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Senator Gazelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that gives me more information, but I was just curious if we know what the compliance rate in North Dakota is. If Minnesota is 17% not in compliance, you know, I'm just curious what North Dakota was. I don't know if you know Mr. Cummings or not.
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't know their level of compliance. I also don't know the level of compliance activity that the Department of Revenue undertakes in North Dakota. I know that throughout the last 10 years we have gone through a time in which we have been doing greater compliance initiatives, and I know in North Dakota with increased revenue streams, they have had less of a need to think about types of compliance initiatives or thinking about their revenue system.
Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was, in response to Senator Ortman's comments, I was sort of going down the same road. You know, I think tobacco, much like some of the other products that we see, I serve on the Commerce Committee. I mean, they're legal products, but they're ones that we do for safety or public health reasons want to keep some track of. It does, I think Senator Ortman raises a point, though. It does sort of beg the question of year 2015 and, you know, is there a better or more or less onerous option for retailers than $100,000-plus piece of equipment that depreciates over 10 years and then has to be redone? So if nothing else, maybe this gives, as Mr. Chairman, you said earlier, nothing like a committee hearing to kind of bring everyone's attention to an issue. It just seems like in the 21st century there must be some way with technology to accomplish what the state needs to accomplish in a way that might be easier for the retailers or wholesalers.
Senator Artman.
Mr. Chair, just a final
just
comment
a second.
From me.
Mr. Erickson, did you want to respond to Senator Reiner?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to reiterate that, you know, that would work if every state had the same state tax. You know, I mean, then, you know, I don't have a problem with Snickers and anything else I sell in North Dakota, Iowa, you know, Wisconsin, et cetera. But we all have a different tax rate. And so there has to be a way to track that. We pay $4.40 a carton in North Dakota, And that's just, I mean, it's an honor system. I mean, we report to them, and we do it legally, but we report to them every carton that we sell in North Dakota and send them a check for $4.40, and they take our word for it. But we would, you don't want to go that route.
Does Senator Reiner?
Brief follow-up, Mr. Chair. And to be clear, I'm not advocating to get rid of. I just sort of, to build on Senator Hartman, wonder if there isn't a way with technology to replace a stamping machine that feels very 19th century.
Senator Hartman.
Mr. Chair, it does feel 19th century, but I'm a little puzzled at the fact that we want to ensure that there's tax compliance, but I'm also hearing from the distributor here that really that tax stamp is accomplishing a different purpose, which is to maintain the market, to control the Minnesota market and make sure you can make your sales here because no one else will have the stamp. On the other hand, you're saying the state should pay you back for that.
That isn't what he said, though. He said that he would go to North Dakota and buy the cigarettes and sell them in Minnesota.
Well, right.
But he just wouldn't pay the Minnesota tax.
Right, and Mr. Chair, that's my whole point. Is the purpose of the tax stamp to maintain the market base for Minnesota-sold cigarettes, or is it to mark the tax compliance on those cigarettes?
Well, Senator, what I hear is it's for the tax compliance because the customer could go to North Dakota and buy them and bring them back.
Right, but
the company can't.
Well, Mr. Chair, right, but we don't want that because that would then eliminate some of our market share.
Right. Mr. Erickson, and then to Senator Nelson.
Yeah, just to comment that, I hope you don't think that I did not say I would go to North Dakota and buy cigarettes.
Clearly, I know you wouldn't do that.
I would not do that. But what's going to happen, it would hurt the state because the Minnesota retailers would go in droves over the state line if they could save $29, $30 a carton. I mean, that's what I'm getting at. I would not go there and buy them.
Mr. Cummings, and then Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I mean, part of our vision is that everyone pays, reports, pays, receives the right amount, no more, no less. And, you know, part of that also is saying, are you reporting and paying and receiving the right amount? Is your competitor just down the street reporting and paying and receiving the right amount? And as we work towards tax compliance, we're also finding that whether you pay the tax or whether you don't is could be a large incentive for you as you're trying to develop how you're making money. So we have seen a couple cases in which there are pallet loads of tobacco that have been brought up from other states that have been brought forward. Now, as it relates to the tax stamp with tobacco, because of the different shapes and sizes, one of the things that we've heard recently is, can we do that for tobacco products because it works with cigarettes? Now, with the cigarettes, the wholesalers have various machines that make it very easy in order to apply stamps in large quantities. But as it relates to the tobacco products, we're not there yet. But part of the question is, because it works well for that in terms of tax compliance, is that a place that we could go for tobacco? Now, we're not there, but those are the, you know, I'm not hearing to go in the other direction. We should remove cigarette stamps. You know, I'm hearing people ask the possibility of moving the other way. And again, I'm not advocating for that, but I'm just trying to describe the discussions that that people have been talking to us about.
And we're going to go to Senator Nelson, Mr. Erickson, and we'll come back to you. But members, think about what this issue is highlighting as a tax policy. And for cigarettes, there might be good reasons for what we've done. But we're highlighting that being an outlier is sometimes complicated. Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. It has been a very interesting discussion, and there's this dueling purpose that I see regarding these stamps. One is it a way to get tax compliance? And certainly there would be other ways, but now I understand from the retailers that also these stamps are a way then to keep out cigarettes from other states. So there's that dueling purpose, which does point to the problem with being an outlier. But on the other hand, I think it I'd like to see more discussion about this. I'm just not really sure what the answer is. On the one hand, one could say that having these stamping machines is a cost of doing business, just like any other business. But if it's purely for tax compliance reasons, then one would understand why there should be a discount given for these machines. But if the real purpose, if one purpose of these tax stamps is to actually keep out products from other states, then maybe that's not the role of the state of Minnesota to discount these machines, because they're, in a sense, protecting, being used to protect the product of the realtor or the marketer. So there's a dueling purposes here, and I think we should probably figure out if there are better tax compliance methods, and then maybe the tax stamp is not so much for compliance, but it's more to regulate what products come into the market.
Senator Gazelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, it's kind of funny. I'm learning about something brand new and giving you different perspectives. But so if I understand it correctly, to sell cigarettes in Minnesota, you have to buy from a Minnesota distributor. But Minnesota charges dramatically more in taxes than everyone else around us. And what's interesting about that, and why I hope we continue to look at this, is it is creating a moral dilemma for being too far an outlier. And the reason why I say that is a comment that Mr. Cummings made. Right now we have 17% noncompliance, but it was much lower earlier. So there's this rising incentive. And so I hope we continue to look at it. I've learned something brand new today, and we've got to figure out, you know, we don't want to create a situation where more folks are tempted to do something they shouldn't be doing either.
Mr. Erickson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I would just like to comment to Senator Nelson also and the whole committee is that Henry's Foods or a wholesaler like myself has nothing to – I make the same amount of on a carton of cigarettes in North Dakota as I do in Minnesota or any other place, even though I sell one for $70 and one for $40. So really what you I'd like to get back to the basics of why I'm here, and that's just – I'd like to be reimbursed for my cost for collecting the portion of the $458 million that the state brings in. And that tax stamp kind of assures you of getting that $458 million. If that tax stamp wasn't on there, you'd have cigarettes from North Dakota, but New York, all over the place. They'd be coming in here by droves, and you'd have no protection to guarantee that you're going to maintain that $458 million. I mean, it would be impossible. So, again, that's not my purpose of being here. My purpose of being here is to get reimbursed for my $100,000 a year that I have to put out of pocket. I can't raise my prices of the product to cover that. So, you know, because that's mandated by the state of what I can sell them for. So I would just like to be reimbursed for the cost of my and other wholesalers of collecting the tax for the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. Anyone else wish to testify on Senate file number 1252? Mr. Bryant, anything else? Senator Hartman.
Well, respectfully, I was with you, and I was supporting the bill until I realized that you have a financial interest in stamping the cigarettes. Because if you didn't stamp the cigarettes, there would be all kinds of cigarettes flooding in from somewhere else. So it's in the marketer's best interest to stamp those cigarettes and to have this whole tax compliance program from the state of Minnesota. And so the cost of running the stamp machine benefits the state, but it also benefits you and your industry. And so then I have a hard time saying the state should pay you back for that. I think in the best of all worlds, the state would understand that the taxation and the whole of the product has put us completely out of the market. And that's what Senators Nelson and Gazelka were getting at. We're not competitive, and the stamp is the only thing that's helping you sell those cigarettes in the state of Minnesota.
But Senator Hartman, if the other unstamped cigarettes, they would be illegal sales, and we certainly don't want to encourage illegal sales.
Mr. Chair, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that they have an interest in stamping these cigarettes because it's keeping the market going.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, so Mr. Chair, I just want to be very clear that I don't think we need to be competitive in encouraging more smoking in our state. So I want to make very clear that my comments were not at all directed to wanting Minnesota to be more competitive in encouraging more smoking in our state.
Anything else, members? Nothing like a little tobacco debate. Seeing none, nobody else wish to testify. Anything else, Senator Coonan?
No, that's the
Mr. Erickson, say hello to Richard for me.
I will. See him tomorrow.
Chair will lay Senate File 1252 over for possible inclusion, as amended.
Thank you.
Thank you, members. Senator Senjum. Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm here this morning to present to you Senate File 1894, a bill that has to do with the taxation related to cigars. And, I'm here, and I thought long and hard, Mr. Chair and members, about whether or not to even get involved in this bill. And I would just say if we're here to talk about the health effects of tobacco, we all know what they are. I don't think we need to do that. I wouldn't have gotten involved in this bill if we were to talk about the health effects of tobacco, because that's a foregone conclusion. We know where you are. I quit smoking 49 years ago. It's not good for you, et cetera, et cetera. But
and
nonetheless,
Senator,
I think it is
Senjum,
important to talk about the tax policy.
If I could
policy.
Interrupt you, just brief, I want to reinforce to the members, we're really here for the tax policy of this conversation, as Senator Senjum just commented about. And try to keep
exactly.
And Senator Senjum.
Mr. Chair and members, the tax policy I think is a critical thing to talk about here today, and whether or not in the case of these cigars we use tax policy to control behavior, or whether or not tax policy in my mind as it appropriately ought to be applied is to equitably fund government. And I think in this case perhaps we've drifted a little bit and are using tax policy to in fact try to control behavior. Mr. Chair and members, this bill is rather simple, actually. It strikes the so-called hand-rolled from the definition of a premium cigar, meaning a cigar could potentially be machine-rolled, and it reduces reduces the maximum excise tax imposed on distributors of premium cigars, and the tax would be the lesser of 95% of the wholesale price. Or now 50 cents as opposed to $3.50. And I would say, Mr. Chair and members, as I again thought about this bill, if we're going to, tax according to what we think proper behavior should be in terms of certainly health care consequences and all that goes along with that, there are certainly other things which are part of our life, which are legal, which do impose health care consequences at times, things as simple as automobiles, motorcycles. You can go to any hospital in Minnesota and it has a rehab unit, and you can see people that drive motorcycles which have been involved in crashes and which are suffering medical issues. We can talk about alcohol if we want to. Should that be, frankly, taxed at the same level that these premium cigars are? And we can go down and down that road if we want to tax according to our wishes to control behavior. But if we want to try to be equitable about tax policy and apply some level of fairness to how we tax things, whatever they might be, then I think this is a good discussion to have today. Mr. Chair and members, I want to bring forth and call forth my witness, Mr. Wolk. He's a cigar store owner. I've just met him this morning, but he's, I think, well-versed in talking about this issue from the standpoint of a business case.
Senator Eaton, did you want to add something first? Mr. Wolk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. My name is Mark Wolk, and I own and operate Stogies on Grand, a premium tobacco shop. I represent the third generation in our family involved in the premium tobacco business in Minnesota. Stogie's has been at the same location for 18 years. We are a small business with real ties to our community, and we are a part of the fabric that is historic Grand Avenue in St. Paul. I'm here today to ask you to change our tax cap to 50 cents per cigar to align with our neighboring states. There are just a handful of premium tobaccos in Minnesota, and most of us employ 10 to 12 people. We are retailers with the Minnesota tax distinction of being distributors since we purchase our products out of state. We are currently being burdened with the highest tax in the country at a rate of 95% of cost or $3.50 cap per cigar. Our neighboring states, such as Wisconsin and Iowa, are currently at a 50-cent cap. We have to compete with our neighbors and the Internet, who sell a box of 20 cigars for $60 to $90 less than we can. That leaves both our store and the state of Minnesota at a huge disadvantage and ultimately the losers in revenue. People come to our store to try one or two cigars, then shop out of state or on the Internet for more favorable prices on box purchases. Each year, our buying power diminishes because, unlike other industries, we have to pay the monthly tobacco tax before our product sells. Starting in January of 2015, a loophole in the statute was found, and we were required to begin paying 95% tax on our freight charges. Yes, you heard that right. That is 95% tobacco tax on the freight. This added another 50 cents to every cigar in that box of 20. Premium tobacconists are purveyors of fine products just like wine and coffee, and our customers are similar. We are a gathering spot for people of all walks of life from every social and economic background. People enjoy a fine cigar to celebrate happy and momentous times in their lives. Our store has never had an underage violation. We do not promote to young people, nor do we encourage that business. Our business should never be lumped together with hookah, glass pipes, or discount cigarette sellers. When I've heard others come and talk about tobacco issues, they keep pointing out that underage kids are smoking less. That is what we all want, and goes to our point that premium cigars have never and will never go after that demographic. We are 100% against underage smoking, and we will always be for strict enforcement, not overtaxation, to deter their behavior. I very much appreciate you allowing me to speak to you today. Both the retail tobacconists and the state of Minnesota could be the beneficiaries of a change in the tobacco tax and cap. Thank you.
Questions, members? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wolk, thank you so much for coming today, and I always appreciate when businessmen and women take time out of their daily schedules and all the things you do as a small business owner. I know you wear a lot of hats, to come and testify before us about bills that are important to you. And I understand your comments were very solely focused on the cost of the tax. I have a different question for you, and that has to do with actually the premium cigar itself. And those are all hand-rolled, if I understand. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Mr. Wolf.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chair. And then my next question is, would you envision that premium cigars would ever not be hand-rolled? In other words, would they still be considered in your mind a premium cigar if they were not hand-rolled or hand-constructed?
Mr. Wolk.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. The way we define a premium cigar as such right now, hand-rolled is part of that same definition. Yes, I envision hand-rolled and premium in the same breath.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
I'll save my other questions till later. Thank you very much.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, if we remove the hand-rolled requirement, wouldn't you expect that machine-made cigars would declare themselves as premium to get the tax break?
And Senator Nelson, members, I would draw your attention to, it's been pointed out to me on page 1, line 9, this removes the hand-rolled definition and goes to hand-constructed.
That's my concern,
yes.
Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Senator Eaton.
Going to answer my question?
Mr. Holton.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Eaton, Court Holton, Cigar Association of America, which is the manufacturers. What makes a premium cigar is the quality of the cigar. And you've all seen them. They're about like that, and they are the most expensive cigar leaf on the market, and they're carefully made. Presently, there is machines that can start creating these premium cigars. And so if that was not in the bill, it wouldn't be a big deal because we're looking more down the road to the future on that. There's very little of that happening right now. But what makes the premium cigar a premium cigar is absolutely the top-of-the-line leaf that you can purchase at auction.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Eaton.
So you don't think that if I owned, say, I produced Swisher Sweets that taste like cherries, that and I could claim on the label that I had premium tobacco in it, and without the requirement of hand-rolled, that I couldn't get that tax break?
Mr. Holton.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Eaton, it would make a difference as how this committee, wrote that tax law. There's more than the hand rolled in your present definition of a premium cigar, and a little cigar under your present definition, even if you removed hand rolled, would not qualify for tax purposes as a premium cigar.
Thank you,
Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll preface my question by saying, and I don't know, Mr. Chair, that you want to have this today, but I do think there is a great policy conversation to have around not just tobacco, but other products like alcohol that we have tax policy with. It's always sort of puzzled me, especially on tobacco, that I think we have come to rely on it for general fund purposes, but my view has always been that the tax was meant as a behavioral disincentive, but I don't think that's the conversation for today. My question, Senator Senjum or testifiers, is I'm trying to understand whether hand-rolled or not hand-rolled. I get the concern of our retailer who's here today about the differences with our neighboring states, yet it strikes me as almost identical to the conversation we had on the previous bill, and it strikes me as almost identical to any number of bills we see in commerce on some other products where we do have substantial differences with neighboring states, sometimes higher, sometimes lower. Why are these special? Why are these the one product we want to equalize versus any of the myriad others that we might be looking at?
Senator Senjum. Mr. Holton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Reinhart, and I'll just go through to answer your question what some other states are doing. And most of the states do have a special category for premium cigars, and that has a lot to do with the cost of premium cigars. For instance, if you had a $400 box wholesale of premium cigars, which would be really a really good cigar, the tax in Minnesota, and that doesn't even include all the tax, would be at least $380. So when you're putting this together, if you think that the people that buy those and have discretionary income are going to pay $380 in tax alone for a box of cigars when they have options, you're not dealing with reality. Now, 10 states have cigar caps at or near 50 cents, and 4 states charge tax premium cigars per cigar, like 4 cents a cigar or something like that. 15 states have the flat tax like we have percentage-wise, but it's so low that a cap wouldn't make any sense. And no state has a cap of $3.50. We're far and away the highest. Iowa and Wisconsin have at least mid-range tax on tobacco products, but they have a 50-cent cap per cigar on cigars, because otherwise what has happened here would happen there. If you want to buy good, high-quality, premium cigars, and you live in the metro area, go to Hudson, Wisconsin. There's a booming business. They got plenty of stores, and they have a 50-cent cap, and that's where our metropolitan sales are today. We tried 350. The bill started out at 50 cents. We got to a 350 cap to see if that would work. It didn't. We're suggesting let's try 50. If that doesn't work, the tax committee will be in session every year and a different figure or plan.
Mr. Holden, just so can I understand your testimony, you talked about a $400 box of cigars and the tax being $380. How many cigars are in that box?
20.
So wouldn't that be $70 of tax?
Pardon me?
Wouldn't that be $70 of tax, because it would be 20 cigars times $3.50?
That's correct.
Oh,
that's
correct. Yeah, you're right.
I was
figuring the 95%.
Yeah, so, but it's capped.
So my figure was wrong, but the idea is still valid.
I'm just double-checking. Senator Reinhart first. Senator Reinhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple follow-up comments. And I still sort of struggle with why these are different in the big tax policy debate, and that's I guess what I'm looking for. To me, we have these two underlying issues that probably warrant further conversation. One is, what is the purpose of our tax policy around tobacco? Is it to provide general fund dollars, in which case I think that is one argument for how we tax products. The other is, do we want people to not smoke? And I think that's a different tax policy. The other is, and it's one we've dealt with, Mr. Chairman, many times, and that's just online shopping, and how do we make the field fair for our bricks and mortar businesses on Grant Main Street or Grand Avenue in this case. And sir, you're in that boat, you know, and we have the Best Buys and businesses that are in that boat. And you know, we took the step a couple years ago to tax the online sales, at least through places like Amazon, to try and equalize that field. But you know, we still have, I'm a service member, and I know people that will go to the Navy Exchange to buy bigger products and then not pay any sales tax, because it can be a substantial savings. So, I mean, I think you helped bring forward just a larger issue that we just have to continue to try and figure out how to solve, because otherwise as you said, our active small business people that are in our communities, participating with their neighbors, being good civic corporate citizens, are really at a disadvantage.
And Senator Reinhart, I don't know exactly what the future. There was a bill introduced this week, I believe, that deals with vaping, and it's partly driven by the 95% of wholesale tax that's on these OTP, other tobacco products. And so I don't know if we're going to see that bill or not. I don't know what the future lies for that, but this conversation is around, and it's being driven by this 95% of tax on OTP products. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Senjum, I guess my question is, do you think that the tobacco products, the cigars, are less carcinogenic than cigarettes? I mean, is there a reason you want them to be more accessible and cheaper?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, Senator Eaton, of course not. They're certainly, from a health hazard point of view, I don't think anybody would debate that they are hazardous. They also are legal. And I think, as I talked earlier, let's think about taxing according to equitability and fairness, as opposed to trying to control behaviors.
Mr. Chair?
Madam Chair, if we're going to tax according to controlling behaviors, then you know I don't advocate that, but you know there's a road we can go down if we want to do that, because there's lots of other things that are legal that frankly have medical consequences.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you. Which you bring in the whole policy issue, and which is why I have to say I cannot support making any tobacco product cheaper. Cigars are known to be more carcinogenic than cigarettes, And I don't know that I want to spend $2 million on getting rid of the tax on cigars. It's a pretty high price in our general fund budget.
Senator Senjum.
Mr. Chair and Senator Eaton, I can respect that. If you are of the bent that you want to use tax policy to control behavior, that's certainly your privilege as a member of the Senate. And I'm just here to, I think, have the debate. What is the proper tax policy on this item or a lot of other items? I think this is the place we have to have it. If we don't have it here, it doesn't occur anywhere. So.
And Senator Senjum, we've got a list of testifiers that are going to testify in opposition to your bill, so I think we should move on to some of that testimony. Thank you, Mr. Holton and Mr. Wolfs. Ms. Waldock and Dr. Mattson.
I have some handouts for committee members.
Thank you.
Yes. So thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Janelle Waldock, and I'm the director of the Center for Prevention at Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota. And I'm here today speaking on behalf of the Raise It for Health Coalition, which is a coalition of many health and nonprofit organizations that advocated for the tobacco tax that passed during the 2013 legislative session. We believe strongly that tax policy is health policy because of the strong implications that the decisions made in this context have on health, which is why we're weighing in on this bill. The coalition has significant concerns with Senator Senjum's bill. It would effectively walk back progress that we have made from the legislation that you already passed in 2013. Research released earlier this year demonstrates that the tobacco tax is having a powerful and positive effect. It's motivating smokers to quit and preventing kids from picking up the habit. Further, the tobacco tax is projected to save billions of dollars in health care costs. These are both significant wins for our state. While it's true that cigarettes are more commonly smoked than cigars, that's no reason to apply a whole different set of rules to them. They are no less addictive and no less harmful. There's no logical reason to give them a special preference. The new premium cigar carve-out was created in 2013, and before that time, cigars were taxed just like all other tobacco products. We were opposed to the change at that time because over and over, we have seen how the tobacco industry manipulates product design to take advantage of loopholes and special definitions. For example, you may remember how the industry manipulated cigarettes as little cigars to take advantage of a much more favorable tax classification. There's no reason to believe that today's issue is any different than that. Don't be fooled. The word premium is a bit of a misnomer, as you've already discussed in this hearing today. It simply refers to the construction and the packaging of the product. If this proposal moves forward, the maximum tax on a cigar, on any cigar, will be reduced from $3.50 to 50 cents, an 85% cut. The tax on a $4 cigar would equal 50 cents. The tax on a $100 cigar would equal 50 cents. I work to reduce smoking and to create healthier Minnesota communities. So from my perspective, I just have to ask, how does this make any sense? This proposal represents bad health policy and bad tax policy. And in short, there's only one entity that this bill will benefit, and that's the tobacco industry. It's bad for everyone else, and most importantly, it's bad for Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Mattson.
Mr. Chairman, thank
you. Would you stay in case there's questions?
Yes, I'm happy
Mr. Chair,
to.
I do have a question for you.
Okay, we'll get that right after Dr. Mattson. Dr. Mattson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dr. Lisa Mattson. I reside in Plymouth, Minnesota. And I thank you for allowing me to be here today to voice my strong opinions against Senate File 1894. We live in a society where cigars are very much glamorized. It's already been stated here that they are used for celebrations. We think of cigars as being associated with successful, powerful people. And this has an impact on our youth and some of our poor members of society who strive to be more powerful and successful. But cigars are not benign. By definition, a cigar is made up of multiple forms of tobacco wrapped in a premium tobacco leaf. They are 100% organic, which I've heard as an argument, but organic is not necessarily meant to be healthy. This is a classic example of how marketing is meant to sometimes just mislead people. Nicotine, which is part of all tobacco, along with 19 other carcinogens that is part of anything that has tobacco, these are all bad things for us. Nicotine is the addictive part, and then there are another 19 carcinogens in any type of tobacco. We absorb nicotine through our lungs, but we also absorb it through our cheeks. So even when people inhale cigars, which they oftentimes think is healthier, you're still getting these chemicals into your system. I'm a gynecologist, and some people may wonder why this is important to me. For women, the number one cause of cancer death remains lung cancer. But another very unknown fact is that when women get nicotine into their systems, we will find very high levels of nicotine in, of all places, a woman's cervix. The human papillomavirus that causes cervical cancer, in very simple terms, loves nicotine. So women who use tobacco products are more likely to develop cervical cancer. And the same mechanism we're finding is more and more common in the reason for increase in head and neck cancers that we're seeing in tobacco users, whether they're smoking it or chewing it or just letting it sit in their mouths as vapor. Minnesota has always been a very healthy state. And right now we have our lowest level of smoking ever, and we need to aim to make that even lower. We do know that by increasing taxes, we have decreased the number of smokers. We had a white paper that was published this past February that found major decreases, and we know that over 60% of people who quit smoking or decide not to cited the cost as an example of why they may have not smoked anymore. Tobacco is tobacco. All nicotine comes from tobacco, and we need to do everything we can to minimize use. As leaders, we need to endorse healthy lifestyles in our constituents and in my patients. We need to encourage exercise, healthy eating, and we need to do everything we can to discourage tobacco use. So I strongly urge you to leave the tax on premium cigars where it currently is. Senate File 1894 only serves to move the health of our state backwards, not forwards. Thank you very much for your time.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick, just an assessment. You can confirm whether this is true or not, because we're talking about cigars, not cigarettes. But it's my understanding that kids don't really – the cigar is not the entry-level tobacco. It's the cigarettes, which is why when the prices went up, smoking went down. So I want you to confirm, number one, that is true, that it's not really cigars. And secondly, as the taxes have gone up on tobacco, cigar use I don't think has gone down. My guess is that it's gone up, and so that there's really not the correlation that there was with cigarettes. And so if you don't agree with that, I need to know why.
I'm not sure that we have any data on cigar use. Sorry.
Dr. Mattson.
I'm not sure we have any data on cigar use, and you may be correct there, but I would argue that anyone who's over 18 still has they're not entirely mature adults yet. And if you go to the fraternities and sororities at University of Minnesota, having a cigar to feel like you're successful and powerful is not an uncommon thing anymore. So while it may not be in 7-year-old hands, it's still in young people's hands. And if we decrease the price on a $6 cigar down to $3 by taking away that $3 cigar, it's going to be more accessible to even our college students. And I think we need to discourage that.
Thank you. And perhaps if some of the next testifiers would know the answer to that, that would be helpful. Anything else, members? Thank you. Thank you. Dr. Lupker and Ms. Morris. And to the tax issue, please.
Chairman Squee and members, I am Russell Lupker. I am a cardiologist at the University of Minnesota. I'm also Mayo Professor of Public Health and an American Heart Association volunteer for over 30 years. I hate to say how many years. I appreciate the opportunity to join Dr. Mattson and express my strong disapproval for Senate File 1894, along with any effort that seeks to provide tax relief to the tobacco industry. I personally testified here before the bill increasing taxes on tobacco 2 years ago, and the result, I have to say, has been phenomenal for the health of Minnesotans. Research demonstrates that raising the price of tobacco helps people quit. prevents youth from starting, and saves lives. Just this year, we saw the percentage of adult smokers in Minnesota fall to 14.4%, among the lowest in the country. Our efforts to make all public spaces tobacco-free and the issue of secondhand smoke has made significant progress, and at the university we have declared our areas smoke-free, both indoor and outdoor. Raising the price of tobacco plays a role, as does providing cessation treatment for people who are addicted. So why would we want to undermine this and these efforts by giving a tax break to premium cigars? So what are the health effects of cigars? Actually, the facts are well known and not in debate. Cigar smoke, like cigarette smoke, contains toxic and cancer-causing chemicals, harmful to both smokers and non-smokers who are around them. Actually, cigar tobacco has a higher level of cancer-causing compounds, nitrosamines and tars, than cigarettes do because of the way it's cured. Cigarettes or cigar smoking causes oral cancers, the lips, the tongue, the mouth, the throat, and cancers of the voice box, the esophagus, and lungs. For those of us who care for patients that have these cancers, I can tell you, this is a horrible way to die. So a premium cigar, as we're discussing here, can have around 20 grams of tobacco in it, the same as a whole pack of cigarettes. The tax on a pack of cigarettes is $2.90. $3.50 is not much different from that. Same amount of tar, same amount of nicotine as a whole pack. Some say cigars are safer because you don't inhale. You still get the oral cancers. But people from our studies who have also smoked cigarettes, and many use cigars to cut back or switch back and forth, if you smoke before you inhale, and you get the same effect, like heart attacks, my interest, as you would if you smoke cigarettes. So in summary, there's a lot of work that you as a committee can do in this session that will benefit the health of Minnesotans, but including Senate File 1894 in your final tax bill is not one of them. The harmful effects of cigar smoke are well known and not debated. I strongly encourage you to stand up to the tobacco industry for the health of Minnesotans and not give a tax break to premium cigars. Thank you for your attention.
The only thing I would say is this doesn't impact the tobacco industry. It impacts our local retailers. Ms. Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Michelle Morris. I'm with the American Lung Association in Minnesota. I have a master's in public health from Columbia University. And as a public health professional, I believe it's important to draw your attention to the Health in All Policies movement. It's happening across the country. And this is the recognition that nearly all policies influence health, for better or for worse. So please consider this as you decide the impact that you want this bill to have. Some may argue that we're too hard on tobacco in the state. I'm not one of them. I'm the first person to say love the smoker, hate the smoking. Minnesota has a history of being tough on tobacco, and we're proud of it. The first smoke-free workplace, the tobacco lawsuit and settlement, a free quit plan program, the wildly popular Freedom to Breathe, the tobacco tax, last year's e-cigarette policy. Together, they are what has driven our smoking rate down and saved untold numbers of kids from smoking. We should be celebrating these policies, not undoing them. And yet what this bill is proposing is what we've seen so many times from the tobacco industry, a chipping away at the policies that protect the people and jeopardize tobacco company profits. So who should we let set our public health standards? Greedy people profiting at the expense of others' pain and early deaths, or public health experts promoting health for all based on best practices? Policies like tobacco taxes are popular statewide and are proven to work, both in decreasing health care costs that we all pay for and by encouraging smokers to quit. As lawmakers, you are here to represent the people and their interests, not the lobbyists of a dying tobacco industry. As a public health professional who has lost a loved one to tobacco, my interests are always in favor of policies that support smokers in quitting, protect youth from exposure to smoking, and prevent youth from being targeted by big tobacco. I ask you today to stand up for Minnesotans, for our public health, and for our youth. Be proud of what Minnesota has achieved, and keep tobacco prices high in our great state. Thank you.
Any questions, members? Seeing none. We have two more testifiers for the Raise It for Health Coalition. We've already heard from them. So if Ms. Shamba and Ms. Hoeks could come forward, but keep it brief. We've already heard from your organization. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, to your point, I just wanted to say we're here to talk about the tax policy and not talk about the bad effects of smoking, because I think we all recognize that. And so if there's, I would hope that our testifiers would keep their comments to the tax policy.
Thank you, Senator Armin. I tried to remind people to do that. Welcome to the Tax Committee, Ms. Samba. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name.
Mr. Chairman, members of the chamber, I am Sheku Samba. I live in Brooklyn Center. I am a member of Multicultural Advisory Council in Brooklyn Center, working with the police and the community in order to promote healthy relationship. I am proud to live in Minnesota, being one of the healthiest states because of your relentless efforts to put some common sense policies in place. And despite that, it is clear that the burden of smoking falls disproportionately on minority populations in Minnesota. Many ethnic groups use tobacco at a much higher rate than the general population. Cigars, in particular, are fashionable products. They are used as they are considered as much of the status product, particularly among men. Higher cigar prices result in decreased consumption. But if you make these products cheaper, it will be easier for price-sensitive smokers and much more youth also to buy and use these products. Cigars cause cancer and many other fatal diseases. And minority populations have higher decreased disease disparities. Such preventable public health tragedy does not occur by accident. It emanates right from the policies that are made from here and the manner in which tobacco industries target our communities. In Brooklyn Center, I helped pass a policy that keeps cigars out of the hands of children and other people. I'm very proud of being part of that process. Since price has a profound effect on the smoking prevalence, especially among youth, I therefore urge you to reject this proposal today and continue to work and continue to make progress in reducing secondhand smoke exposure, disease, and deaths caused by tobacco epidemics. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Samba. Sorry for not getting your gender proper.
Sheku Samba.
Sorry about that. Ms. Hoeks.
HOTEP, Mr. Chair and committee members, I appreciate this brief opportunity to provide testimony this morning. My name is Aura Hoeks, and I am an alumna of the Leadership Institute to Advance Minnesota's Parity for Priority Populations. We are working to improve health equity for diverse communities in our state. As a member of a community that experiences more harm than the general population from tobacco, that uses tobacco more than the general population, that has higher rates of lung cancer, heart disease, and other diseases caused by tobacco, I had to ask myself, why would anyone ever support making tobacco products of any kind cheaper? Obviously, the tobacco industry has a reason. If tobacco products are cheaper, more people are going to buy them. History shows us that manufacturers and retailers manipulate their own prices, offer coupons and discounts, and target specific communities and income levels, all to keep people smoking and keep people buying. The repeal would be good news for them. Just a couple of weeks ago, there was a report showing...
Just a second, Ms. Hope. Senator Thompson.
I think we've given... You have been very gracious in giving a fair amount of latitude. I'm hearing nothing even remotely close to a tax policy discussion in this right now.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While I understand your point of view, Senator Thompson, these are citizens who have come in to speak on their concerns from their community, and I think we need to hear them out.
Continue, Ms. Hoeks. Continue, please.
The repeal would be good news for them. Just a couple of weeks ago, there was a report showing that tobacco companies are some of the highest spending lobbyists in Minnesota. So it's clear this is their favorite type of legislation. And I suppose it's also good news for a certain type of man who likes to smoke big cigars. Big cigars have a symbol of wealth, power, and status for over 100 years. A cigar can make a man feel powerful and important. It's true. It can kill you, but it's true. But what you might not realize is that you don't have to be wealthy to afford these cigars. Some of these so-called premium cigars can be bought for about $5. That's $5 now, before the tax break. If this bill passes, you will be able to buy them for about half that. There's no question that's going to get many people smoking. No question. Look at it this way. The average price of a pack of cigarettes in Minnesota today is about $7.50. In some parts of the state, it's even higher. If this bill passes, you'll be able to buy a big, cheap cigar for about $2.50. And who do you think is going to be hurt most by that? I can tell you. It's going to be men in my community. It's going to be men who are trying to catch up in our society, who wants to seem successful, seem affluent, seem powerful, authoritative. And it's going to be their families, their wives, their parents, their children who have to breathe in cancer-causing secondhand smoke. You may think supporting this proposal does no harm to anybody, but it makes tobacco products cheaper and push them down into the reach of those who might not otherwise be able to afford them. Make no mistake, you are adding to the overwhelming burden that already bear from the deadly problem of tobacco use. I ask you to help improve health equity by opposing this policy. Asante sana, and thank you again for allowing me to testify. And thank you, Sister Edith.
Thank you both for your testimony. Thank you very much. Mr. Narum? Ms. Narum, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kayla Narum. I am a volunteer with the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. I'm originally from Andover, Minnesota, and currently reside in Minneapolis. I spoke before this committee 2 years ago as you debated the merits of an increase in Minnesota's tobacco tax. I relayed the story of my father, who I lost to esophageal cancer from smoking just 1 week after my 14th birthday, and the tremendous toll that it took on me and my family. Because of tobacco, he wasn't there when I graduated from high school or college, he wasn't there to guide me as I entered the workforce, and he won't be there someday to dance at my wedding. I told the story to remember my dad and hopefully in some small way be a part of making sure no other family has to go through what I did. 2 years ago, This committee listened to the facts and made a wise decision. You heard about the potential to reduce smoking rates and raising the price of tobacco. You learned how high prices keep kids from starting and how less smoking makes a healthier state and reduces health care costs. And so you voted to increase the price of not just cigarettes, but all tobacco products, including smokeless tobacco and cigars. 2 years later, we know the tobacco tax is working. Smoking rates are at the lowest level ever reported for both adults and youth in every age group. Why would anyone want to reverse this success? We cannot talk about taxes in a vacuum. They are part of a larger issue. Cigars contain the same cancer-causing agents as cigarettes and emit more secondhand smoke. Unlike cigarettes, smokeless tobacco products and cigars come in candy and fruit flavors that make it easier for kids to take the first puff. Combined with lower prices, these products are attractive to children and teens. I'm here today to remind you of the wisdom that that 2013 tobacco tax increase and encourage you to protect the integrity of this important public health policy. Rolling back this tax will only do two things: make cigars more affordable for cash-strapped teens and increase the cash flow of tobacco companies. Please do not weaken the law and create a loophole for cigars. Choose the health of our community and our kids instead. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions, members?
Mr. Chair,
Senator,
just
Ruttman.
A quick question. Ms. Narum, I'm sorry about the loss of your father.
Thank you.
Do you think that tobacco products should be illegal in the state of Minnesota?
Ms. Narum.
I believe they should be. I don't feel that anyone should be using tobacco products. It has no benefit as far as I can see and has only caused a lot of hurt and pain for my entire family.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Seeing nothing else from the committee, Senator Senjum. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to point out a couple things that have, I think, been lost in this discussion. One is people make an individual choice to smoke. And certainly many, many years ago, the health risks were not known. In fact, we all understand that they were covered up. They're known now. I'm 53 years old, and since I was a little kid, I have been inundated with information about the dangers of smoking. It is still an individual choice. People choose to do it. Secondly, if the cardiologist were to continue to testify, he can certainly verify that there are lots of things that are unhealthy for us and for our cardiovascular condition other than smoking. I have too much of a penchant for pizza, and I'm sure that that's not a good idea. When we go down this road of, as I apologize, I've forgotten the lady's name that was in public health and went to Columbia, indicated that the public health experts know better. Where does that stop? We have public officials in New York trying to control the size of beverages that we drink. I read the other day, and of course now every health threat that comes up, it's, quote, the new smoking. I read that being sedentary is, quote, the new smoking. That if you sit in a chair too long every day, that's as dangerous as smoking. And so the concern I have is we don't talk at all about the fact that the individual who chooses to smoke is making a decision. I choose not to smoke, but I don't think other people should be prevented from smoking. And then the second thing is, where does this stop? Sugar is dangerous. Fat's dangerous. Excess carbohydrates are dangerous. Sitting too much is dangerous. Too much stress and anxiety is dangerous. And if we accept the premise that it is not the individual's responsibility to monitor those things in their lives, there is no stopping point. The nanny state goes forever. And that I just feel that needs to be said, because all we heard today was when people smoke, it's somebody else's fault, and that we just should assume and accept the premise that it is society's responsibility to decide what I inhale or ingest rather than mine. And that's just a dangerous road to go down.
Members, I gave a lot of leeway to the public, but I do expect the committee to focus on the tax issues. Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Thompson.
If I may just respond to that.
Yes, Senator
Thompson. I would have been happy to do that had the testimony focused on that. But virtually none of the testimony focused on that. So I feel that if the chair allows testimony on completely unrelated issues, then members have the right to comment on it.
I'm sympathetic to that, Senator Thompson.
Thank you.
Members, from now on, let's focus on the tax policy. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am interested in focusing on the tax policy, and particularly just three brief comments. One, we mentioned about whether this bill was related to smoking or tax policy, and if I think Senator Sinjum mentioned, you know, is it about tax policy to control behavior? And yes, we do that. That's what tax policy does. Whether it's mortgage interest rates being deductions for those, or whether it's savings plans like IRAs, Roths, college 529s, deductions for K-12 expenses, dyslexia expenses. We do that in this committee all the time. So let's not kid ourselves. Tax policy is involved in controlling behavior, or we wouldn't say controlling behavior, but we would say incenting behavior or disincenting behavior. So that's just a basic of one of the things we do with tax policy. And I also want to state that I am particularly sensitive to all of our small business owners in this state, and particularly when they take time out of their day to come here and testify before committee, and particularly the many, many ways that our state increases the cost of doing business in Minnesota. I think that is a significant issue, whether it be the way we tax a general business property tax, send it right into the general fund. We continue to put barriers in front of our businesses in regards to the cost of doing business in Minnesota. And so I was listening intently to Mr. Walk talk about the part in this bill that actually significantly reduced the tax on the premium cigars. While that is significant, I think the more significant part of this bill is actually in Section 1, which didn't get a lot of discussion, but that is actually striking out in the definition of premium cigar, the fact that it's hand-rolled. And I almost feel that that is really worthy of greater discussion here, because a premium cigar is a very premium cigar in a very distinct, hand-rolled way, according to current definition. But I am puzzled that in this bill, which all the testimony was about reducing the tax on these premium cigars, the real issue is the fact that the definition is changing about what a premium cigar is. And so we're taking out the fact, if this bill were to pass, that it's hand rolled. Suddenly, one could see machine cigars being produced in mass quantity, and while they still might fall under the definition of premium cigar in our legislation, the fact that they're no longer hand-rolled makes them cheaper to produce, more of these produced at a lower cost, which does get into that very market that is so price sensitive. And so I'm most concerned about the deletion of the words hand-rolled in this particular bill.
Senator Sinjum, your thoughts on the definition?
Mr. Chair, I would, and maybe counsel can help me, there's been two individuals that have commented on the definition. I would move that we delete subdivision 13A. Let's take that out of the conversation.
Ms. Pollack, does that accomplish the conversational goal of eliminating and retaining the hand rolled as a definition of a premium cigar?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, the motion would be to delete Section 1 of the bill.
Senator Sinjum moves to delete Section 1?
Yes.
Any questions, members? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Section 1 is deleted. Senator Eaton.
Mr. Chair, I was going to pretty much say what Senator Carlson or Nelson did. I'm sorry.
Very good. Senator Orton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree that when we look at a tax bill, it has tax policy implications, and we look at the reasons for the tax policy. Why would we deduct the mortgage interest rate? There are good reasons to do that. But then we also don't dismiss the economic impact. And I think that's Senator Sinjum's point here, is that there is an adverse economic impact by our tax policy, and he's asking us to explore that, to say that the impacts are hurting Minnesota businesses, hurting the Minnesota economy, keeping us from being able to compete with similar businesses in other states, and can have an impact in hurting jobs. And so I don't think we should dismiss those arguments either. We should recognize the tax policy in both respects, the justification for the current tax and the justification for maybe lowering that tax. And I appreciated Senator Senjum's bringing this bill forward. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 1894? Anything else, members?
Mr. Chair, earlier Senator Gazelka asked for some data,
and I do have it,
if you would like it. So quickly, he asked about youth tobacco or youth cigar use. So the Minnesota Adult Tobacco Survey, which is administered by the Minnesota Department of Health, 2014 data shows that in the category of cigar use, cigarillos, and little cigars, so it's not just premium cigars, but the broad category, that the use went down from 13% in 2011 to 8.2% in 2014. And that's the first drop that we've seen in that category for youth in many, many years, and it's attributed to the raise in the tax. So just wanted to offer as follow-up to his ask for data.
Thank you, Ms. Waldeck. And I understand it's hard to get good data because the OTP products are all kind of lumped in together, so it's hard to pull out one section or another. Anything else, members? Senator Senjum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for having this hearing today. I'm sitting here thinking about how can we even measure that if it's not legal for youth to buy cigars. So I won't go down that path any further. But, Mr. Chair and members, I got involved in this bill from the standpoint of wanting us to think about tax policy, and I've said that several times. I sincerely believe that, you know, education is the answer to smoking and smoking cessation. It's not tax policy. It shouldn't be tax policy. It is education. And I don't think there's a person in this room would agree or believe, rather, that smoking is a good idea. In fact, most of us don't. But nonetheless, to use tax policy as a lever, if you will, to try to control behaviors, I don't think is a proper use of tax policy. I think it ought to be, as I said earlier, about providing fair and equitable funding for government. That ought to be the direction that we take here. If we want to go down the other way, there's a lot of other things that we could tax. There'll be one, two, three, maybe four people today killed on Minnesota highways. We wouldn't think of taxing an automobile at the proportional rate of taxation we're taxing cigars. There'll be people entering. Maybe people dying, people entering rehab units, families destroyed over alcohol today. We wouldn't think of taxing alcohol, albeit we tax it pretty heavily at a rate proportional to cigars. And so I just wanted to bring this whole issue of proportionality up and taxation relative to taxing behavior versus taxing the proper funding of government.
Well, Senator Senjum, you've piqued the committee's interest with your closing statement, so we're going to hear from a couple of them. But members, we are 20 minutes over already. So Senator Reinhart first, and then
Thank
Senator
Mr.
Martin.
I'll be brief. I know I've got constituents waiting upstairs. Senator, I agree with your last comment. I think that proportionality issue is certainly one worth discussing, but I couldn't disagree with the first part of your comments. I think tax policy is entirely about incenting or disincenting behavior. I will concur with Senator Ortman. I think it always has economic consequences that we do want to explore in that conversation, but everything we do in tax committee incents or disincents some sort of behavior. That's why we do it. Thank you.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Senjum, I think Senator Nelson made very well the case. We often do tax policy. We constantly do tax policy for other policy reasons. We do incent behavior. We do disincent behavior to do that. Some of us do want to see alcohol taxes addressed to address that issue. I don't want to go into it further, but I think Senator Nelson explained very well how many ways we do this already.
And Mr. Chair, my final comment would simply be, should we? Should we? Is that the basis for tax policy? And we've had a good discussion today, so thank you.
And Senator Eaton, I missed her, so Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say that, yes, we should. Our governor and our commissioner of health have stated that we should have a policy of health in all policy, that we should look at what the outcomes of our behavior and our decisions are in the health of our community. And I believe in that very strongly as a nurse. And it's part of being public health is part of that issue. And that's what we're talking about here. We all pay the price for people's bad decisions. Healthcare is going through the roof. We're paying for people's bad choices, whether it be pizzas or cigarettes or whatever. And we need to continue to educate and work on health in all policies.
Well, it's clear that clear we're going to have continued debate in the legislature. Thank you for the discussion today, Senator Senjum, and to the testifiers, thank you all for coming today. We are meeting tomorrow morning at 8:30, series of members' bills. Chair Lay, Senate File 1894 as amended, over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Senjum. And members, I guess I've made the announcement a little premature about tomorrow morning. No more work today. Committee's adjourned.